You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is part three in our series on French explorer Jules Dumont d'Urville. Here are notes for today. First, a reminder that we are doing a giveaway of the book Daring French Explorations by Hubert Sagnier. It's a beautiful book and follows a bunch of French explorers around the world between 1714 and 1854. It's great stuff, and entry to win the book is free. There's a link to all of it in the show notes or on the website explorerspodcast.com. And speaking of the website, if you want to see a map following d'Urville as he returns to the South Pacific, there's one on the website, so go there to check that out. And final note, I mentioned in past episodes that our series star, d'Urville, would circumnavigate the world three times. But that is wrong. It is only two. Sorry for that error. Anyhow, that is it for notes. On with our story. So, last time we left d'Urville preparing for his return to the South Pacific to pick up where the Coquille expedition had left off. There would be mapping and charting and all the typical science stuff, but that was the official public spin on the expedition. He also had some secret orders. These orders focused on finding a good place or two for France to establish colonies in the region, especially in Western Australia and New Zealand. For France, they specifically were interested in a penal colony, just like what the British had established on the eastern shore of Australia. It's important to know that France did not have a colony in the South Pacific, so finding a place was a strategic imperative. For the expedition, d'Urville was given the services of the Coquille, which had just circled the globe. It was a good, solid ship, and it would be refitted for the upcoming voyage. And d'Urville and the officers were aware of the vessel's strengths and weaknesses. The ship was renamed the Astrolabe, and there is a story behind the renaming. First, it was done to distinguish the upcoming voyage from its most recent circumnavigation under the command of Louis-Isidore Duperrey. The second thing about the moniker is that Astrolabe was the name of one of two ships that had sailed with explorer Jean-François de Galoupe La Pérouse. In 1785, La Pérouse departed France on a grand expedition of discovery, and he'd gone all over the place. Chile, Hawaii, Alaska, California, Japan, Russia, Australia. It was an epic adventure. But in early 1788, La Pérouse left Australia, bound for places such as the Solomon Islands, but he and his crew were never seen again. The disappearance of La Pérouse captured the attention of the French nation. A rescue mission under Admiral Antoine Bruni d'Entrecasteaux was sent, but nothing found. Rumor said that the British were responsible for the disappearance. For decades, people wondered about what happened to La Pérouse and his ships. There's even a story that King Louis XVI, on the morning of his execution in January 1793, asked if there had been any word about La Pérouse. Anyhow, there was word that evidence about the fate of La Pérouse and his expedition had been discovered. It is something that d'Urville will keep a lookout for on the upcoming journey. For the expedition, d'Urville was given royal approval in December of 1825, just 9 months after having returned from his first voyage of discovery. He arrived in Toulon the next month. Preparations were thus begun for the voyage, and things were not that different than on the ship's first expedition as the Coquille. There was food, supplies, gear, and trade goods brought on board. The latest maps and charts and reports were gathered. Passports from the governments of Portugal, Great Britain, the Netherlands, and Spain were requested and granted. This gave d'Urville permission to visit the ports of these nations to seek aid and assistance, something that was very important since, as we pointed out, France didn't have many places to go in these areas. Now, enough about the Astrolabe. Let's chat about the crew and officers. First, regarding the crew, they were experienced men, mostly from Toulon and the surrounding area. However, amongst the ordinary sailors, only one person, the ship's carpenter, was back for the return voyage to the South Pacific. In addition to the crew, Derville added a contingent of 5 Marine Fusiliers and a corporal. The expedition had run into too many situations on the last voyage where a few veteran soldiers would have come in handy. Plus, none of these men were natives of Toulon or the surrounding region. This meant that they would not be influenced by ties to the crew if there was unrest. Derville knew that they would be on his side if any disputes arose. Now, amongst the officers on the ship, the second in command would be Charles Jacquinot, returning from the Coquille expedition, now a lieutenant. The next man in the command chain was Victor Charles Lautin, also from the Coquille expedition. Derville respected both of these men, and he knew he could trust them. Some others of note include Victor Amédée Grisine, an ensign who had served with Derville on the Chevrette. Grisine was a decorated and respected officer, but also rash and prone to depression. The ship's surgeon was Pierre Lesson, the brother of René Lesson, who had been on the Coquille. Pierre, like his brother, would come to loathe Derville. The Astrolabe would have 2 experienced naturalists, both of whom had been on the Freycinet expedition from 1817 to 1820. The first was Jean-René Constant Croix. He was an introvert, precise and methodical. In addition to being a surgeon, he was a respected zoologist and artist. He would make 6,500 drawings of the expedition. The second naturalist was Jean-Paul Gaimard. Also a surgeon, Gaimard was said to be the opposite of his partner. He was an extrovert, well-liked by everyone. The two would make a fine team. The expedition's official artist was Louis-Auguste de Saint-Saëns. He would make many wonderful drawings capturing the events of the voyage. All in all, it was an experienced and quality crew. On March 29th, Derville's wife gave birth to a son, Jules-Eugène Ecker. On April 8th, Derville received his official orders. 17 days later, the Astrolabe set sail. Leaving Adelaide and his son was heartbreaking for Derville, but he had done it before. This was his time to shine, to make a mark on the world. And Derville believed he was destined for great things. He had ambitions and the ego to match. That he had to leave his wife and infant son was the price that was required. And so the Astrolabe would set off, and things would start out well. The veteran officers and crew knew what they were doing, and things clicked. Author Edward Diker, in his biography on Derville, said, quote, "They acted like men who had already served 6 months at sea together," end quote. Now, one thing about Derville that had not changed, despite his position as commander of the expedition, was his penchant for casual attire. He was, to put it politely, untidy. He wore his official uniform only when needed. He walked around without stockings, and there was his old straw hat. If weather permitted, he wore it. Pierre Lesson said, quote, "He was careless to his person," end quote. The Astrolabe arrived at the Strait of Gibraltar on May 3rd, but it did not pass through due to bad weather for more than a month. The British entertained the French ship and her crew, giving them a tour of the fortifications, which boasted more than 600 big guns. It was a way for the British to demonstrate their power and might. Derville took the time to dine with his British hosts, as well as visit the surrounding Spanish villages and collect plant specimens with the naturalists. The Astrolabe would finally get to continue her voyage on June 7th, sailing through the strait and into the Atlantic Ocean. A week later, the ship arrived at Tenerife in the Canary Islands. Derville was disappointed to have missed British Captain Philip Parker King by 2 days. King had done extensive surveys of Australia, which Derville admired. He had hoped for advice on surveying the waters of New Guinea. Unlike the previous time in the Canaries, Spanish officials were willing to allow the French crew ashore. Derville visited the island's acclaimed botanical gardens, and he hiked to the top of Mount Teide, along with the naturalists Croix and Gaimard, following in the footsteps of Alexander von Humboldt, the most celebrated naturalist of the era. The Astrolabe took on supplies, including 900 liters of wine. The next stop was the Cape Verde Islands, where Derville still hoped to run into Captain King. However, no luck. He missed him by 36 hours. The ship then went down the coast of Africa, going slowly due to calm winds and waters. On July 20th, the Astrolabe crossed the equator, which meant a big party as the men celebrated with the ritual dunking of those who had never sailed into the southern hemisphere. After that, the ship caught the northeasterly trade winds towards Brazil, reaching the islands of Trinidad and Martin Vaz at the end of the month. Now, here, Derville took a different course than the previous journey. Instead of going around the tip of South America, he caught the westerlies and headed back across the Atlantic and rounded the Cape of Good Hope, aka Africa, and sailed into the Indian Ocean. Rounding the Cape and going into the Indian Ocean offers some of the roughest waters in the world, and the ship would be pounded day after day after day with huge swells and wave after wave. One day, Derville reported the ship took on 7 inches of water in just 6 hours. He compared the waves to mountains, and these turned out to be deadly. On September 12th, a sailor was swept over the side of the Astrolabe by a huge wave. He was quickly lost in the rough waters. Another time, the ship's quartermaster, Michel Vignal, fell during a storm and suffered a severe head injury. He would never fully recover and die 2 years later. Despite the tempestuous waters, the Astrolabe would make good time across the Indian Ocean, sighting Australia on October 5, 1826. 2 days later, the expedition reached King George Sound on the southwestern tip of the continent. The Astrolabe had been at sea for 108 days. So, let's remember that a key element of D'Urville's mission was to scout out places to establish a French colony and naval base. On the previous voyage, the French had done a cursory look at the Swan River estuary, which is the location of modern-day Perth. Why D'Urville didn't go there right away and do a more in-depth look at the Swan River area, I don't know. But King George Sound, which is about 350 miles or 560 kilometers down the western coast of Australia from the Swan River, had been visited by explorers, starting with George Vancouver in 1791, and offered an intriguing opportunity as a colony and port. Anyhow, the Astrolabe would ultimately make its way into the Sound and investigate the two harbors with their small boats. This included a yawl and a whaleboat. In one harbor, the French were approached by an Aboriginal Australian man on the shore. He was given some bread as a gift, and he was delighted. He began to laugh and dance and sing, and he called for his friends to come over. The man would join the British and board the Astrolabe, showing no fear, only joy and curiosity. He was thrilled by the presents he was given. And thus, so far, things had gone well with the native people. D'Urville and his crew would thus begin their study of the King George Sound area. An observatory was set up, and the naturalists collected plant specimens as well as some birds. Soundings of the bays were conducted, and everything was mapped and charted. D'Urville likely went on some of the excursions to collect plant and wildlife specimens, but we really don't know exactly what he did and didn't do. As the commander of the ship, he had so many other duties to attend to, and while it probably pained him, he had to, at times, leave the science stuff to others. D'Urville found the area had potential. The anchorages were good, and there was plenty of water. The soil, however, was iffy, and hunting was limited. Still, he felt it was a place that could support a colony. While at King George Sound, the Astrolabe would be visited twice by groups of Europeans. The first was on October 12th when a boat of sealers, 7 Englishmen and a Maori, came to the ship. They said they had been with a schooner and had been left here 8 months earlier. The schooner had never returned. 3 of the men asked to come with the French. D'Urville suspected that they may have been escaped convicts. The second group, actually 2 boats from a larger vessel, arrived 5 days later. Some of these wanted to come with the French as well. D'Urville was happy to take on any able-bodied man. Plus, it gave him the opportunity to find out more about the local people, their attitudes, the landscape, and the plans of the British. They could also help D'Urville with his study of the language of the Aboriginal Australians. From King George Sound, D'Urville sailed east under Australia. Now, he intended to go to Port Dalrymple, today known as Georgetown, on the northern shore of Tasmania, which was known as Van Diemen's Land at this time. This meant sailing between Australia and Tasmania through the Bass Strait. This was not a simple thing. There are over 50 islands and countless reefs and submerged rocks. Add in unpredictable winds and currents, and it's a dangerous route that had claimed many, many ships. Also, D'Urville's food was running low. Half of his tins of meat were found to be bad. He wanted to reach Port Jackson to resupply sooner than later. D'Urville would thus stick to the Australian coast and end up landing at Western Port Bay near modern-day Melbourne. Here he found a small colony of sealers. The expedition spent a week at Western Port Bay. The naturalists would make some scientific discoveries, including 6 new beetles. However, the big excitement was the discovery of a particular saltwater sea clam. No live sample had ever been found of it, only fossils. How excited were the scientists about this? Well, when the Astrolabe would later be threatened by reefs near Tongatapu, it was the only item the naturalists would take with them when they left the ship. Anyhow, the Astrolabe continued up the Australian coast, surveying and exploring as they went. At Jervis Bay, the expedition encountered some Aboriginal Australians, who D'Urville described as gentle. Jean-Paul Gemer would record 158 words of Wandandian Aboriginal words. As I mentioned last time, Derville was generally not impressed by the Aboriginal people. He often describes them as ugly. Edward Dyker, in his biography of Derville, notes that our French explorer seems to admire the natives he encountered who had not been corrupted by European influences. Other explorers, such as James Cook, had come to this conclusion as well. European goods, religion, and customs had made these people greedy and venal, upending their culture in just a handful of years. Men like Derville and Cook saw an innocence in these more primitive native peoples. The Astrolabe would fight storms as she moved up the Australian coast before reaching Port Jackson and the city of Sydney on December 2nd. They anchored off of Fort Macquarie, which is where the famed Sydney Opera House now stands. In the harbor, there were three British warships, a reminder to the French of who was boss in the area. And let's be clear, the British knew exactly what the French were up to. They knew they were interested in Australia, and they pointedly told Derville that the continent was their area of influence. Of course, Derville would play dumb and tell them there were no worries. They were just on a scientific mission. But everyone understood the situation. The British, in fact, were already working to counter the French. They would establish a fort at King George Sound later that year. One at the Swan River would follow a few years later, and full-fledged settlements would be established shortly thereafter, and thus the French would lose out on putting a claim on Western Australia. Perhaps if Duperrey on the previous voyage had done a rigorous survey of the Swan River, it would have been different, but who knows? Derville would learn about the plans of the British to establish outposts in the West, but there was nothing he could do about them. Instead, he set his sights on the next leg of his journey, a return to New Zealand. Perhaps New Zealand would be where the French could set up a colony. But first, he repaired the ship, replacing rotting planks, and added supplies. This included biscuits, veggies, tobacco, salt, rum, salted meat, coffee, sugar, coal for the ovens, and water. Derville commented that he was better supplied leaving Port Jackson than he had been leaving Toulon. After that, it was off into the Tasman Sea, bound for New Zealand.
Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals and ready in just 2 minutes. Every week, there are 35 different options to choose from. Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, all available, along with 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and get after your goals. The thing I love about Factor's meals is they are packed with flavor. Meals such as pork cheddar chili and mac, filet mignon and mushroom risotto, and salmon piccata. But what's also cool is that it's not just about dinner. For breakfast, there are a ton of options, including banana walnut overnight oats and apple cinnamon pancakes. And there are smoothies, juices, desserts, and other snacks. So sign up and save. It's less expensive than takeout. And what's really cool is that we can save you 50% on your first box. Head to factormeals.com/explorers50 and use code explorers50 to get 50% off. That's code explorers50 at factormeals.com/explorers50 to get 50% off. Enjoy.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Derville's initial plan was to approach New Zealand from the bottom and go up the coast, but strong storms, which the Tasman Sea was famous for, blew the ship further north, and they would drop anchor at the northern shore of the South Island at a place called Separation Point on January 14, 1827. The location is not far from where one enters the Cook Strait. This is the channel that separates the North and South Islands. By the way, if you do not know, New Zealand is separated by two main islands. They are conveniently called the North Island and the South Island. Here Derville would find the Maori of the South Island to be different from those in the North. The land was more rugged and the soil not as good and the weather not as mild. The people here knew about white men and firearms, but contact with them was limited. All of this made the Maori a little more primitive than those on the North Island. By the way, Derville conversed with the natives using the Maori language guide that had been put together by Thomas Kendall, an ex-missionary he had met on the previous voyage. It made communication possible, but far from perfect. As time goes on, Derville's knowledge of the Maori language will become quite good. Relations with the Maori were, mostly, friendly. Now, let's remember DeVille was looking for good places to set up a colony and anchor ships, so he went about surveying the waters between the North and South Islands. One thing he did, which I like, was to talk to the native people and try to find out the names of places, such as islands. He then gave the place the name used by the locals, although he didn't always do this. Hence, we have Pepin Island, in honor of his wife's family, and Quasi Harbor, named after his mother's family, and there's Adelaide Island, named after his wife. All those names have stuck to this day, although they officially have Maori names as well. D'Urville and his team thus sailed along the northern shore of the South Island, surveying the coast, engaging with the natives, and collecting plant and animal specimens. D'Urville was still a keen and energetic walker, taking part in the plant and animal collecting. He liked to boast about it, which annoyed the ship's surgeon, Pierre Lesson. Lesson wrote to his brother René, saying how much he disliked it when D'Urville went on excursions, as he was so vain and wanted everything to be about him. I've said before that D'Urville was ambitious, and he had a high regard for himself. But I also want to note that he was becoming more prone to bouts of melancholy, even depression. I think that taking on the role of commander put a heavy weight on D'Urville's shoulders. In the past, he could blame others if something went wrong or he disagreed with a decision. But now he had nowhere to look but himself if he ran into any sort of trouble. And the pressure got to him at times. No matter, the astrolabe continued into the Cook Strait and started to make its way through an extensive network of sea-drowned valleys called the Marlborough Sounds. These channels are infamous for their strong currents and rough waters. On January 25th, the astrolabe would attempt to navigate one particular narrow, rock-strewn channel, the ship twice scraping potentially deadly rocks. The astrolabe would, however, make it through the channel, which separates the South Island with another island, today called D'Urville Island. The channel is now called the French Pass. By the way, there is a wonderful painting, based on a sketch from the expedition's artist, Louis-Auguste de Saint-Saëns, depicting the astrolabe as it sails through the pass. I put a link to it on the website. Once through the Cook Strait, the astrolabe would turn north and sail up the eastern coast of the North Island. For a time, the ship had a Maori chief and his companion on board. They were helpful as interpreters in their knowledge of the land. They would, however, not stay long due to both men getting seasick. D'Urville and the astrolabe would struggle as they pushed up the New Zealand coast due to strong winds and storms. In fact, on February 15th, the ship sailed into a monster storm. It was such a ferocious gale, everyone thought the ship was going to be driven aground. It was during the storm that D'Urville would be seized by indecision and doubt. He was exhausted and stressed. Pierre Lesson wrote that D'Urville, quote, lost his head during great danger, end quote. D'Urville admitted in his own journals that the situation was so bleak, he considered driving the ship aground rather than have it strike a reef and sink in the ocean and the crew perishing. However, Charles Jacquinet stepped up at the critical moment and kept the crew focused on saving the vessel. D'Urville seems to have followed his second-in-command's lead, and the ship avoided disaster. The astrolabe would continue up the New Zealand coast, meeting various Maori chiefs as they conducted surveys. The island the French found was wrecked by warfare. The musket had dramatically altered the life of the Maori. One army was said to number 4,000, all armed with muskets. Just a few years earlier, the largest army only consisted of 1,000 musketeers. The island's most powerful chief, Honjihika, had recently been wounded and would die a year or so later. As the ship approached the tip of the island, they would visit various missionaries. These missionaries lived behind protective walls and were generally afraid of the Maori due to the fighting. From these missionaries and the Maori who came to them, D'Urville would learn a lot about the native people, their language, and customs. Thomas Kendall, the ex-missionary who D'Urville had met on the previous journey, was away at the time, so he was not able to tap into the man's knowledge a second time. The astrolabe took on provisions, including food and water, and departed New Zealand on March 18, 1827. The ship added a sailor, a Maori named Kakako, who had served on other whaling ships in the past. D'Urville loved this as he was able to tap into the man for all sorts of information about the Maori people and their culture. By the way, no matter your thoughts on D'Urville, you cannot fault his passion for learning about the culture and languages of other people. In the second volume of his account of the astrolabe, he would devote more than 300 pages, roughly half the book, to the Maori people. The astrolabe sailed north, aiming for the Tongan archipelago. D'Urville wanted to survey the islands and compare his work to that done by Antoine Brunet d'Entrecasteaux more than 30 years earlier. The voyage was, however, slow due to weak winds. They only made 100 miles, or 165 kilometers, in a week. The expedition, however, was dogged by a few issues. First, some of the food had to be thrown overboard, as 56 of the 68 tins of chicken were found to be bad. Second, venereal disease was an issue as it cropped up amongst the crew. And third, there was a bit of a malaise amongst the men. Common sailors were often a moody, unpredictable bunch in this era, and the men of the Astrolabe were no different. They had been at sea for a year. Disease, illness, and homesickness took its toll, and just confining the men to a ship for such a long time allowed for issues to fester and boil over. And we can't forget that some of the men that D'Urville had in his crew had been brought on board in Australia. This may have included some runaway convicts, not the most reliable men. Add in the fact that D'Urville was not the most inspirational leader, and it makes for some uneasy moments, and we will see that play out shortly. So the Astrolabe would reach the Tongan archipelago on April 2nd, and then spend more than a week battling a series of storms. By the 11th, the weather had calmed, and the day featured a fascinating moment when the men woke to find Chrysippa butterflies, aka the African monarch, covering the ocean. D'Urville speculated that they had blown from Tonga in the storms. It's one of those things you read about where people experience something simple but extraordinary at the same time. Anyhow, the Astrolabe would reach the island of Tongatapu on April 20th. D'Urville sailed the ship between Tongatapu and another island, Awa. It was in the channel between the islands that the wind suddenly calmed, and the Astrolabe became a victim of the passage's strong currents. The ship, despite its sails in play, was pulled onto a coral reef. Thankfully, the Astrolabe would free itself from the reef after 4 hours without serious damage. The ship, however, was in a dangerous situation. The winds and currents wouldn't cooperate, and as the tide lowered, the Astrolabe found itself stuck in the channel. The winds were too weak and the waters too shallow to continue to safe anchorage. The men tried to secure the ship's position so it wouldn't get carried onto a reef. It was at this time that the ship was swarmed by the Tongan people. There were so many, D'Urville only allowed the prominent chiefs on board. They were also visited by a young Englishman named James Reed. Reed had been a cabin boy when his ship had been wrecked in 1821. He had survived the massacre of the crew. D'Urville recognized that he would be useful as an interpreter. Reed also brought a letter of introduction from Reverend John Thomas, a missionary on Tongatapu. And it wasn't long before two other Englishmen came to the ship, including William Singleton. Singleton had been shipwrecked in 1806 and had settled on the island and had a Tongan wife. D'Urville liked Singleton, who was kind and gentle, and he asked him what would happen to the Astrolabe and the crew if they were shipwrecked. Singleton said that the ship would be looted by the native people, but the crew would be safe. He advised D'Urville to make a pact with one of the island's powerful chiefs, a man named Palou, to gain his protection if such an event occurred. Palou, a big man, was thus welcomed aboard and shown deference. D'Urville talked to him, asking him about his childhood memories of the visit of Antoine Bruni d'Entrecasteaux. That night, one of the ship's lines snapped, and the Astrolabe lost an anchor. Only one line kept her from being dragged by the whims of the currents and winds. The ship spun around and was precariously close, no more than 10 feet or 3 meters, from the reef. The crew lowered the longboat to help pull the ship from the reef. They also dropped another anchor further away. The ship would survive the night, and the next day the Tongans came out to trade, bringing with them pigs, chickens, bananas, yams, and fruit. D'Urville received assurances from the chiefs who came aboard that they would help out if the ship ran into trouble. The situation of the Astrolabe remained precarious. They were in a channel right next to a reef. If they hauled up their anchors, they'd be pulled onto the reef by the current, and the winds weren't strong enough so the ship could use their sails to counter the currents. D'Urville thus prepared for a disaster. He ordered half of his crew and officers to go ashore, carrying with them only what they needed. It was then that a pair of missionaries, who are unnamed, came to the Astrolabe. They were horrified when they saw the crew evacuating. Despite the assurances of the chiefs, they were sure the Tongans would kill them. The thing that D'Urville eventually learned was that Tongatapu was, like so many other places in the region, subject to ongoing warfare. Long-standing dynasties were crumbling. We saw this sort of thing play out in Tahiti and New Zealand, as the introduction of European technology, specifically the musket, had rapidly altered these places. I want to point out that last year we did an episode on the opening of Japan. The Japanese would figure out how to reproduce European firearms and within 20 years altered the balance of power on the islands using muskets. The same thing was happening on these Polynesian islands. The Tongans knew how powerful European muskets were, and what they wanted were those guns and the ammunition and powder needed. This way they could reign supreme in their battle for control of the island. D'Urville responded by halting the evacuation and then securing all the weapons and ammunition on the ship. He then put all the expedition's official journals and navigational instruments in chests and sent them with the missionaries for safekeeping. He then took the Tongans aside and warned them what would happen if they tried to take control of the ship. He then asked them to help pull the ship out of the channel. This appeal was met with a tepid response. Thus, D'Urville decided he would use his own boats to try and guide the vessel to safety with William Singleton as a pilot. What followed was a dangerous game. The ship's boats tried to pull the vessel away from the reef, but the unpredictable winds and currents refused to cooperate, and the Astrolabe was dragged onto a reef more than once. But each time, the ship was able to free itself without much damage. And then, on April 25th, the ship found itself stuck on a reef yet again. But at high tide, she got free. Now afloat, the sails were unfurled, and the boats proceeded to guide the ship out of the channel into safe anchorage. Disaster was, for now, averted. D'Urville immediately sent some men to collect the ship's journals and instruments. It was then that it was found that all the ship's chronometers had not been wound. Going forward, the French were not able to tell the exact time. This meant that they could not accurately determine longitude, which is kind of an important thing. D'Urville, I'm sure, was horrified, but he had many other things to deal with. He had the ship inspected by divers, and they only found minor damage. The big loss was the Astrolabe's anchors and cables. An attempt to salvage them was thwarted by bad weather. Now, everything seemed okay for the French. They traded for food and supplies. They collected specimens. Saint-Saëns did some nice sketches. D'Urville met with more of the island's dignitaries, including one old woman who had memories of James Cook's visit more than 50 years earlier. As the ship prepared to sail, D'Urville would receive a visit from the Reverend Thomas. He warned him that some of the crew were preparing to jump ship. D'Urville thus elected to keep the departure date and time a secret. The ship finally weighed anchor on May 13th. One of the ship's boats, the yawl, was on the sea to guide the Astrolabe to open water. But also, because of the surprise announcement of the departure, they had to pick up one of the men who had been left on shore. And here the plot unfolded. The Tongans had come out to the Astrolabe to trade one last time, and when they were turned away, all of these canoes suddenly took off, as if planned, taking aim at the yawl. They reached her just as she got to the beach to collect the man left on shore. Within minutes, 500 Tongans had surrounded the men on the beach and taken them prisoner. This included midshipman Henri Farragut and 8 men. D'Urville considered firing his cannons at the Tongans, but was worried about hitting his own people. He thus sent out a longboat with 23 men under the command of Ensign Victor Amédée Gracin. As the French approached the beach, the Tongans fled into the forest with their prisoners. Gracin recaptured the yawl. Meanwhile, more men were sent ashore in the whaleboat with orders to burn anything they could find in retaliation for the attack. The French moved down the beach, their boats sailing along with them in case an evacuation was needed, burning and shooting as they went. It was as they approached a Tongan religious site, called Mahufanga, that the Tongans gathered and appeared ready to fight. As the French approached, they were subject to periodic sniper fire, but nothing much else. And then one of the fusiliers, Corporal Francois Richard, broke ranks and chased some Tongans. This is exactly what they wanted. The isolated soldier was surprised and set upon by about 10 men, who beat him and then bayoneted him with his own weapon. Richard's comrades would rescue him, but he was so badly wounded, he would die a couple of hours later after being brought back on the ship. D'Urville knew Mahufanga well, as he had visited the site just a few days earlier. It was on the shore. He elected to sail his ship up to the site and issue an ultimatum. He told the Tongans that if they gave him his men back, he would depart without any retaliation. If they didn't, he would unleash his cannons and muskets. And if that didn't work, he would go back to Peru, get some French warships, and return and exterminate everyone on the island. The Tongans responded by building barricades and trenches in the sand, and they repeatedly tried to lure the French into a melee, but without success. D'Urville brought his men back to the ship. The French had superior weaponry, but their numbers were a fraction of the Tongans. The Tongans, by the way, were led by a chief named Tahofa, an ambitious man who wanted the French weapons and expertise. He could have killed the French hostages, but he wanted them alive so they could help him use and maintain the European firearms. Also, there was speculation that some of the men on the shore were actually sympathetic with the Tongans and were prepared to desert the ship. One man in particular, Charles Simonet, was viewed as a problem. Some suspect that the work the Tongans would put into setting up their barricades and trenches was under the guidance of someone who understood the capabilities of the French warship. All eyes fell on Simonet. That evening, Derville took a poll with his officers as how to proceed. They all voted to bombard the Tongan positions. And so at 10:30 a.m. on May 16th, the first cannon was fired. The initial blast terrified the Tongans, but soon they came to realize that the cannonballs were pounding harmlessly into the sand barricades, or blasting off the tops of trees. When it became clear that cannon fire was not effective, the French switched to grapeshot, meaning the cannon fired a mass of small projectiles. This caused the Tongans some problems, but the French fire was inconsistent. On the first day, they fired 30 cannonballs and some grapeshot rounds. The Tongans tried to get the French ashore to negotiate, but Derville refused to let his men get too close. He suspected the Tongans would only take them prisoner, which was true. His men did get a better look at the barricades and trenches and found them to be impressive. The next day, the rains arrived, and it put a damper on the conflict. The French would shoot a handful of cannonballs and grapeshot when the weather permitted. That night, they debated strategy. Ensign Lotin wanted to conduct an armed landing, but Derville nixed the idea. He figured that's exactly what the Tongans wanted. Muskets were great, but not facing hundreds, perhaps thousands, of natives. Derville said that he would remain one more day, and if no resolution came, he would cut his losses and leave. Now, if he actually meant that, we don't know, because the next day one of the captured sailors rode out to the ship. He said 3,000 Tongans were dug in. The cannon fire had resulted in only one death, but the Tongans were growing uneasy. They wanted this all to end. The Tongan leader, Tahofa, had hoped the French would come ashore where they could overwhelm them. He would then convince the men to join his cause. Derville was told that two members of the crew, Charles Simonet and another sailor named Raboul, had gone off into the island's interior. Derville wasn't worried about Simonet, who he saw as a malcontent. Raboul's desertion was a bit of a surprise. The man was a good sailor, but also somewhat dim and easily corrupted. Otherwise, the Tongans were prepared to release the rest of the crew in the morning. That was fine with Derville. By the way, the French will depart without Charles Simonet, but he is not done with our story. The night was an anxious one for Derville and his officers. There were rumors that some of the men were ready to mutiny and go live with the Tongans, but nothing came of the threat, and the next morning the rest of the men, save for Simonet and Raboul, returned to the Astrolabe in canoes. It was suspected that a few of the men who had returned that morning had been considering staying with the Tongans, but when the chips were down, they rejoined the ship. On May 21, 1827, the Astrolabe raised her anchors and sailed from Tonga Tapu. Derville had survived a crisis, perhaps even a threat to his command. The next destination for the expedition was the Fiji Islands. Derville intended to continue with his mission and survey and map the area. Which, I want to note, was immensely risky. He had no chronometers, so determined longitude was iffy, and he had lost most of the ship's mooring cables and anchors. These were critical to keeping the ship away from dangers such as reefs and rocks. Anyhow, we will leave off today's episode with Derville sailing west from Tonga Tapu towards Fiji. Next time, the Astrolabe will continue its tour through the islands of the region, including New Britain and Guam. There will also be a return to Australia and the search for the lost expedition of explorer Jean-François de Guadeloupe, Les Parus. So that is it for today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Join us next time as we wrap up the first voyage of the Astrolabe. Thank you for listening. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. Go to airwavemedia.com for other great shows. If you are a movie fan, there are several film history shows, including From Beneath the Hollywood Sign and The Movies That Made Me.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for The French Revolution today.